thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
The living.
Here's John Williams.
It's what we do here for you every day. This is John. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio at 109. Listen to us till 3. After 3, continue to listen to WGN Radio. Remember, our podcast is called The Mincing Rascals. The Illinois Broadcasters Association said our little podcast was best. In the whole state of Illinois. We drop it on Thursdays around 5. We'll do another one for you today. Wherever you listen to podcasts, make sure you listen for The Mincing Rascals. Also on social media, I'm WGN King John. And I'm trying to remember now if I put this on Facebook. I know I tweeted it out this morning because we've been watching Stranger Things on Netflix, plowing through last night all the way to the last episode.
So good.
Now, one more episode to go.
I'm sure you weren't listening to the business lunch today, but the Stranger Things is doing so well that it is lifting Netflix's stock today. And Netflix is doing so well on the stock market that it's bringing the NASDAQ into positive territory on a day when the other indices are down.
Wow. And I think what's weird about this, Griffin probably knows more about this than any of us because he's talked about, reported a lot about this on Saturdays with Amy. They are releasing viewership numbers, which they don't normally do, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but it's you can't verify them because they don't release anything else.
I don't think they would lie.
They use language that is flexible. What does viewing something on Netflix mean? Someone press play, but did they watch the whole thing?
I don't know.
You know, but it's obvious that Stranger Things is a hit, but I don't trust any like hard and fast numbers that they give.
Haven't they done that before, Griffin, where they've come out with numbers and they seem dubious?
Well, they only release them when they're good, too. That's one thing. Or they'll give a stat that with that Ava DuVernay show. Oh, boy, I can't remember what it's called. But they said something like, it's the most viewed new show on our platform. And the language is so, it's like, you don't know exactly what it means, but it obviously sounds good.
Yeah.
It's very press releasey, so I have a hard time. But there's no denying that this show is a huge hit. That's clear just from looking around to people.
Game of Thrones ended, and you thought, well, that's the end of the great television era. Nothing will top that. And then Chernobyl came out, and you went, oh, my God, that's the best show I've ever seen. Or Stranger Things, which isn't in a category like that, but is wildly popular and really fun to watch.
Well, HBO had the same thing, you know, decades ago when they used to never release their viewership numbers either. And then they got their first hit with, not their first hit, but The Sopranos was such a huge hit. They were like, oh, let's brag about this a little bit. Let's tell people.
Yeah, right.
And they kind of got themselves in a bind where then they had to do the same ratings thing that every other network did, or at least they felt like they had to.
My post on Twitter last night or early this morning was because that show is so captivating. The special effects are amazing when the one girl puts on the mask and then she's able to teleport herself to people and scenes. The way they stage that is just really clever. That's not so dramatic special effects wise, but what really is amazing to me is that Flayer character, the monster that turns into a glob and flops along. Oh, my God. I thought of all of the ways I've seen on TV and film to die, that's number one on the way I don't want to go. Number two is the monster in Alien. Remember that? You thought, oh, God, that's awful.
Yeah.
So Monster on Flayer 1, Alien 2. Griff, later on, you'll need to provide us your list of top five ways you don't want to go based on film and movies.
I've got some in mind, yeah.
Lauren, I don't know if this is something that you've thought about in the past, but I'd like your list before the end of this close of business at 3.
I think it would be a tie, even though the Stranger Things, alien, monster, whatever you want to call it, is definitely huge and terrifying. I was always very terrified of the aliens from Signs. The, like, walking ones that click.
Yeah, you spend,
right.
spend so much time not seeing them that I actually, you know, most of that movie is just build up. I'm trying to remember what
it
is.
But see, that's the thing. I don't know if you need to think of what's the most painful way to go or just the most terrifying experience, because sometimes what you don't see can be as troubling as not. And you might just want to go back to, I don't want to get pecked to death by birds, a la, you know,
birds.
By the birds. So whatever it is, this is going to take a little mental investment. I want your answers before the close of business on this show today at 3. Steve, I know you're real busy in the newsroom, but five worst ways to die based on movies or films that you've... Like, you can put the...
I don't have that... Yeah?
You can put the shark from Jaws if you want. It's whatever you want.
Okay, I don't have that kind of movie recall, but...
I mean, the really good stuff is in, like, there's 10 Final Destination movies and 8 Saw movies. Put those together, that's like 6 dozen.
I will say, I have a lot of nightmares about Pennywise from It and Michael Myers, so I feel like maybe those should be my top ones.
I think the way Deborah Winger went in terms of endearment was kind of difficult.
I don't remember how she went. Oh, she just died in a hospital
room, painful death.
I actually, my mind went immediately to mob movies.
Scarface or something like that?
Well, no, more like Sonny, Godfather, or the baseball bats in Casino.
Not a good way to go.
That's probably my number one.
You know, a scene I thought of right away, and I'm tortured about it for a number of reasons, is the way Thelma and Louise died. I mean, that was just kind of bizarre.
Do you want to do this now? I'll get my real list out.
Nope, we're not talking about this right now. Well, because I got to start talking like Ross Perot.
That's not, man. Yeah, go ahead.
I don't mean to be disrespectful to the man. In fact, we just posted on WGNRadio.com a conversation I had with him on the eve of the election in 2000 or 1996. Let me see here. It was on the eve of the election in 2000. Right. So George Bush is about to become president. Ross Perot is at the last minute throwing his support to Bush over Gore. Now, 9/11 hasn't happened yet. And here's the feisty Ross Perot, who was suddenly made available by the Bush people to come on WGN Radio. I'm hosting the show. I'll play a clip for you on that in a second. But I'd forgotten that we'd had this conversation. And listening back to it, it's so classic Ross Perot. Who is Ross Perot? So here's the wiki on him. An American business magnate who's just passed away. Billionaire, philanthropist, politician. He was the founder and former chief executive officer of Electronic Data Systems, EDS, and Perot Systems. Ran an independent presidential campaign in 92 and that third party campaign in 1996. Both campaigns, as an independent, were among the strongest presidential showings by a third party or independent candidate in U.S. history. He started as a salesman for IBM. In 1962, he founded EDS, a data processing service company. That was in 62. In 1984, General Motors bought a controlling interest of his company for $2.4 billion. Then he established Perot Systems in 1988, and he was the angel investor for Next, the computer company founded by Steve Jobs, after he left Apple. Perot gave him the money to get that going. Perot also became heavily involved in the Vietnam War POW-MIA issue. In 92, Perot announced his intention to run for president and advocated a balanced budget and then do the outsourcing of jobs. He wanted to make America great again. And in enactment of the electronic direct democracy, a June 1992 Gallup poll showed Perot leading in a three-way race between President Bush and Bill Clinton. He chose Admiral James Stockdale, all-time favorite vice presidential candidates for 200, Alex.
Yeah, and you know, that's an unfortunate thing because I was just reading or watching a story about Stockdale, who was an incredible hero.
Yeah.
I mean, an absolutely wonderful person.
And you remember him for a line in a debate.
Who am I? Why am I here?
There was a vice presidential debate, and there's the three of them. One of them is Perot's guy. It's weird that Perot's in the hunt, let alone Stockdale. And Stockdale isn't getting questions or answers. And finally, he says that, and people just laugh and go, yeah, you guys aren't ready for prime time. But he was a man with a resume unto itself. So there's Stockdale on TV as his running mate. And he appeared in 1992 debates with Bush and Clinton. In the election, Perot got almost 19% of the vote, the popular vote, but he got 0 electoral votes. We know how that works. He was good amongst self-described moderates. Forbes listed him in 2016 as the 167th richest man in the country, billionaire. The way Robert McFadden wrote about him in the New York Times is perfect. Ross Perot, the wiry Texas gadfly who made a fortune in computer services, amazed the nation with audacious paramilitary missions to Vietnam and Iran, and ran for president in 1992 and 1996 with populist talk of restoring Norman Rockwell's America, died Tuesday at his home in Dallas. He was 89, leukemia. He came from an era when boys would deliver papers on routes, folks tuned to the radio, and patriots rolled up their sleeves for Uncle Sam. He was an Eagle Scout, a Navy officer out of Annapolis, top IBM salesman, founder of that data processing enterprise. He came out against drugs. He was a billionaire philanthropist. In 1969, he became kind of a folk hero with a quixotic attempt to fly medicine and food to American prisoners of war in North Vietnam. In 1979, he staged a commando raid that he asserted had freed two of his employees and thousands of criminals and political prisoners. In 1992, he became one of the most unlikely candidates ever to run for president. He had never held office. He seemed all wrong. He was a cartoon character sprung to life. He was an elfin 5'6". He weighed 144 pounds with a 1950s crew cut, a squeaky nasal country boy twang, and ears that stuck out like Alfred E. Newman's on a Mad Magazine cover. He was stiff-necked. He was cantankerous. He was impetuous. He was sentimental. He was given to homespun epigrams. If you see a snake, just kill it. Don't appoint a committee on snakes, he would say. What was the line you used in the news, Steve? What was the Ross Perot-ism?
He talked about, I'll see if I can find it, but he talked about giving at the debate in 1992, where he was sent a voodoo stick, I think it was, from someone from Louisiana. Let me see.
A woman from Louisiana.
Here it is.
Since we're dealing with voodoo economics, a great young lady from Louisiana sent me this voodoo stick, and I will use it as my pointer tonight.
Okay, go, wait, that's ridiculous. But I mean, but, you know, sticking to the script doesn't have to work. And he was the guy that, I don't know if anybody was paying attention, I don't know, in 2016, but don't you think Ross Perot presaged a little bit Donald Trump?
John the Baptist?
I mean, really, he was like, he was the first apostle of drain the swamp. I'm going to talk directly to the people.
He certainly had the same he went after the same populist appeal.
It's interesting because he did a lot of business with the U.S. government as he championed getting rid of all of the people in the U.S. government and criticizing it. He had it both ways. And so remember, he's before digital media. He's before Twitter, right? He's before Facebook. I mean, way before all of that. And yet he knew how to bend the media. His campaign featured innovative half-hour infomercials about himself and his ideas. He'd buy a half-hour of TV at 7 o'clock on CBS. I think he might have bought it across all of the networks. They were wildly popular in the ratings. They would beat infomercials or sitcoms at the time. Ignoring negative newspaper and magazine articles, he laid siege to radio and television talk shows. Switchboards lit up. People wanted to volunteer. I mean, he had that sort of Tea Party pre-Trump appeal.
I'm trying to remember what the name of the party was because he spawned a party.
Yep. I've got the name of it here, and it sounds like something Trump would champion.
It was kind of a fly-by-night thing. I mean,
oh yeah, United We Stand America. Just throw in some good words.
United We Stand Party or something?
Well, that was the banner.
Right.
That was the banner. Under the banner, United We Stand America, which sounds like Be Best, he spent $65 million of his billions on his own campaign.
But so then after that, so this party tried to continue, and it was, you know, just... But I was doing, with Wes Bleed, used to host a show called Dateline 720.
Sure.
And we would have, you know, he'd have guests come in, and so we had the leaders of this party. I don't remember exactly the name. I'll have to find the name of the party.
Yeah.
The Illinois leaders of the party. And as we're sitting down to do the interview, we get an alert saying that the party has just been dissolved. And so we told these guys, your party doesn't exist anymore.
And you walk out. This will be the last interview you do.
They had no hint that it was coming.
Okay, so let's do this. 122. Griff said, take a break. We'll come back and preview for you a little bit about what he did sound like when he was on our show just before. Billionaire Ross Perot, the presidential candidate, the philanthropist, has passed away of leukemia. And we are recollecting here on the show just an interview that our David Marzullo found. This goes back to 2000. It's the eve of the election. In fact, I think we're just about to vote. And they said, hey, Perot will come on and stump a little for Bush. Honestly, I was a little comfortable that close to the voting, actually putting an advocate for one side on without having somebody on for Al Gore. But I said, okay, let's just go ahead and do it. This is part of our conversation in the fall of 2000 with Ross Perot.
You're hitting the stump, I understand it, for the Republican Party, right?
No. I'm hitting the stump as a man who loves his country and a man who wants to make sure we pass on a better, stronger country to our children.
Yeah.
And we're down to two candidates now.
Right.
And those two candidates are Vice President Gore and Governor George Bush. I have studied the records of both candidates very carefully to decide who I would vote for, because one of them is going to run our country and be the commander-in-chief of our armed forces. And I have concluded that there's a huge gap of difference between Vice President Gore's capabilities and Governor Bush's capabilities. And therefore, I have urged the American people, and including those who don't even plan to vote, to get off the couch and go vote tomorrow. And I urge you to vote for George Bush, because I think without any question, he'll be a president we can all be proud of.
How difficult was it for you to sort of cross the line and vote for one of the main party candidates, like Bush in this case?
Well, I just was looking for the best candidate.
Yeah.
No, it was if it had been in a minor party or wherever he was, the best candidate that has a chance to win.
Yeah, now when
because
you...
we've got to face the fact we can't live with Animal House in the White House any longer. We've got to have the trust and respect restored to the office of presidency. Then I've given you a quick profile on why I feel that Governor Bush
yeah.
will do an outstanding job. Now
yeah.
I switch to Al Gore. First off, being in Congress does not prepare you to be in the White House. All you do is pass laws.
Well, he's
being
been the governor, vice president, though.
About then, yeah, we'll talk about that. Now, he's had a chance, all right, but let me just take it step at a time. Talk about mental competency. Now, I can go on and on. His stories about being in Vietnam.
Whose?
Gore's.
Gore wasn't in Vietnam?
He was in Vietnam, but he claims he was out on the perimeter and being shot at. He was a reporter. He was a private. He had bodyguards
because he was a senator's son. Well, I know that, but that's not fair. If you, well, you
if
must
you'll
know
let me finish, it's fair because he got out in 4.5 months.
He got...
And it's normally a 13-month
hold
term,
on.
But
that's
he got
not
out.
Fair. That's but not fair. This got, no, you know what? This is too close to the election. He asked to be in the infantry, and he asked to be on the front, and they wouldn't put him there because he was a senator's son. Don't believe that if you don't want to, but don't be unfair about it. I mean, my word, win the election on the merits of the arguments.
I want to ask you a question.
Go ahead.
How do you justify the fact that he left Vietnam after only 4.5 months because he said he wanted to be a minister and then dropped out of the ministry?
He never said he wanted to be a minister.
Yes,
he went to divinity. He went to divinity school because
that was his excuse.
How do you explain George Bush's 2-year absence from the records in the National Guard?
I don't.
Well, I think that's a relevant issue if you want to talk about
that. Not nearly as serious as, and I can go. I've just mentioned a few here on him. And then the latest is his experience down there in the Buddhist church, you know, in the church in Houston, where they were having a DEA investigation.
No.
He showed up for fundraiser, and a few days later they shut down the
okay.
DEA investigation.
Mr. Perot, I really appreciate you coming on here. We are out of time. I wish you the best, and I hope you can join us again someday.
Thank you, and good luck to you.
Yeah, good luck to you.
That was incredible. I mean, you're right about a precursor. I mean, so he's taking on... Al Gore's military record, who
yeah.
served,
yeah.
And said that he wasn't worthy of the office, and ignoring George Bush's military record, right?
And he had his talking points. The reason that I was just so rushed with him is because I'm like, I'm not going to let you just throw a bunch of ad hominem attacks here, and then everybody's going to go, oh yeah, what a disaster. Some of the things he was saying just weren't true, or would lead you to believe something that wasn't true, and I didn't want that to be the last thing you heard. I didn't plan on arguing with the guy, but I also didn't plan on letting him just read his laundry list of accusations.
Yeah, and my point of that is you're picking your truth, you know, when he did that, the choice there. And we do that now, too.
Very cantankerous. Very cantankerous. Al Ross Perot. So the full conversation is kind of fun to listen to, too. And that's at WGNradio.com.
And
Steve, lots of texts about Ross Perot. One of them is this from 815. Looking at the Perot for President bumper sticker hanging over our tractors in the barn as you read his bio. He was fun. You couldn't imagine he would be president, and he wasn't. He got no electoral votes, but he got almost 20% of the popular vote.
He had an I mean, he may well be the reason that Bill Clinton became president. I mean, he was more than fun. He may well have been very consequential.
Well, that certainly mattered in the Bush-Gore election as well.
No, Bush-Clinton, the elder Bush, and then he ran again in the second.
Right, but I'm thinking third-party candidates. It's amazing how sometimes
yeah.
a small footprint right. can have huge consequences. In the 2 o'clock hour, speaking of presidents, Andrew Schaefer will join us, the author of Hope Never Dies and Hope Rides Again, which is a very funny, bizarre crime-fighting series. It depicts the dynamic duo crime fighters of Joe Biden and Barack Obama as they zip around town solving crimes. It's very funny. There's a lot going on there, and Andrew Schaefer's in town. He's going to say hi to us in the 2 o'clock hour. And if you've been watching Stranger Things, you'll want to hear our conversation after 2 with Brian Tallarico. In our studio right now is University of Illinois Chancellor Robert Jones. Chancellor Jones, thanks for coming in. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thank you so much for having us today.
I'm thrilled that you're here. I would put you here in any circumstances, but the fact that Andrea Darlis now works for the University of Illinois is probably no small coincidence that we were able to get you into our studio today.
I'm sure it had a lot to do with it.
Is she working out, or has this maybe been a regrettable hire?
We're going to wait and see.
Wait and see?
Yeah, we're going to wait and see.
How do you like that, AD? Say it again.
No, I leave just for a couple of weeks. What the heck happened?
And all of a sudden, we've turned on you.
I know. I bought lunch, too. I don't know what else.
John, I think you realize what a coup this was for us to hire someone with her connections to help us lead and more deeply engage this university in the capital city of the Midwest, the city of Chicago.
Well, when she left, the first thing I told her, I think you'll remember this, Andre, I said, this is the perfect job for you, and it's the perfect hire for the university.
Absolutely.
Nobody knows Chicago media, radio or TV or print better than Andrea Darlis, and she has always sung the Illini song.
Absolutely.
Always. Yes.
We're very fortunate to have her.
A couple of things I want to talk to you about, and one of them is, so what's this big event that you guys have coming up, Illini Fest at Millennium Park, July 18th, right?
Well, it is part of our overarching strategy to increase our presence here in the city of Chicago. I think, as you well know, the University of Illinois is about 151 years old now. We've been anchored in Urbana-Champaign. But because we are a public land-grant university, we have an obligation to serve the masses. And the largest population of this state happens to reside here in the city of Chicago. And we feel very strongly we have not had a very highly visible nor strategic presence here in the city. So Illini Fest is a fun and exciting way to kind of announce and remind people we're here. And we matter and we care greatly about this community. And we want to bring to bear all of the expertise and the power of that great research university to be physically present here in the city of Chicago, and to partner with city, county officials, nonprofit organizations to really help move the city of Chicago to the next level of excellence as we move the university forward.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you make. I think if people in Chicago say, who's the university here that we all champion, there's probably as many graduates as the U of I or students going to the U of I from the Chicago area.
Absolutely.
But it's in Champaign-Urbana a couple of hours away. So there's sort of that disconnect. And then you might say, well, it's the University of Chicago or UIC or Northwestern or DePaul or Loyola. They've all had reasons to sort of percolate up. And we're obviously very connected to Northwestern here. But I think you're right that the University of Illinois probably could increase its top-of-mind presence in the Chicago area.
You said it spot on. That's part of what we're trying to do.
And I guess there's a number of ways to do that. That's the challenge for you all. But how important is it that the teams that represent the school do well? How much easier is it if they do well?
Well, let's just say I would have no problems if we had winning athletic programs across the board. My job would be very easy. But at the same time, athletics is a critical part of our mission, is a critical part of what the University of Illinois is known for. And we're very, very proud of our athletics program. And just stay tuned. Victories are just around the corner, and we're very, very excited about where our athletic program has been under Josh Whitman's leadership, and even more excited about where it's going in the future.
You know, the presidential candidates that are running on the Democrat side, obviously, have been talking a lot about forgiving student debt and, for that matter, free college education that I wouldn't have to pay to go to U of I. What do you make of that?
Well, it's an important concept of college affordability. And one of the things that I've been very adamant about and committed to is keeping education accessible and affordable. And we've continued that commitment here at Illinois. And our way of addressing this, you know, in the absence of some kind of federal mandate or legislation to do so, is to use our own resources to carry out our commitment to access and affordability. And so we started this program announced it last September, called the Illinois Commitment, which provides free tuition and fees for any student who's a member of a family where the income is $61,000 or less, which is the median income for the state of Illinois. And we're providing free tuition and fees. Why? Because, as you said, we don't have the kind of visibility, and there's misunderstandings about the university. There's misunderstandings about affordability. One of the common misunderstandings is that it's so expensive, it's so competitive, you can't get in, and even if you get in, you can't afford it. And so in order, we documented that was a factor for a large number of students who didn't even bother about applying because they said it was too expensive and I can't afford it.
So if my family income is $61,000 or less, mm-hmm. and I qualify to get into the U of I will pay my tuition and fees.
Yes, sir. We will pay the gap, and we will pay the tuition and fees. And for 4 years, too. For 4 years. It's a 4-year commitment.
I think I remember hearing about that, but I don't know that I knew that. That's very interesting.
You didn't see the billboards?
maybe I did, but they're just not top of mind for me right now. $61,000 or less if I qualify. But that is the thing, too. That's the sort of yin and yang of it for a University of Illinois. You want to keep the standards high. You want to get top quality students from around the world. But if you make it easier for people to get in, broaden the base, but then the academic standard is lower. So it's a balancing act, I presume.
Well, it's not a balancing act for us because we would never compromise credentials and qualifications to get access to the university. So we have an opportunity to continue to promote very high quality education. It's very, very competitive to get into the university. But what we found was that one of the biggest misperceptions was that it's too expensive, I can't afford it, so why even bother applying? And so there was a significant number of students who never bothered to apply to the university. And that's what we discovered. And that was the impetus for creating the Illinois Commitment. We want to move the issue of affordability for students who have worked and prepared themselves for an Illinois education, that they can have access to that education. We want to move from the current paradigm where far too many students say, well, I can't afford to go to the University of Illinois. We want the new paradigm to be, I can afford not to attend the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign.
I would imagine that when you meet people for the first time, say just a citizen of the state, and they find out who you are,
mm-hmm.
that the first thing they would tell you is either how excited they were that their son, daughter, niece, nephew went to the U of I,
yes.
or that they were frustrated that they weren't able to get in.
Oh, you've been listening in on conversations, haven't you?
It's a wild guess on my part.
That's the two scenarios, because as I said, you know, students that have the good fortune to get admitted. We know that one of the things we're very proud of, we just don't admit students. We admit them to a degree. And we have one of the highest graduation rates among the Big Ten peer groups. And that's across all social economic profiles as well. And so we have some very, very proud alums. But at the same time, we know that there are folks that are somewhat frustrated because their son or daughter did not get admitted, and we're just trying to open up more opportunities for Illinois residents to receive an education. This past year alone, we increased the number of Illinois residents that applied to the university by 10%, and we've incrementally increased the number of Illinois residents from about 72-73% when I first arrived to about 76% now. So we're absolutely committed to keeping the quality high, but at the same time providing more access to more residents of the state of Illinois.
Give me the headline on two other things before you go. What's this new campus or building that's going to happen in Chicago for the U of I?
Well, it's not a campus in the historical context. In other words, there will not be you can't earn a degree from that entity, the Discovery Partners Institute. It is our way, it's a system-led initiative where we pretty much declare that the University of Illinois system, and specifically as Urbana-Champaign campus and other members of the system, will have a high-impact strategic presence here in the Chicago. It will provide an opportunity for our students to get that residential experiential learning that is difficult to do down in Urbana-Champaign because of the much smaller number of business opportunities. That, we believe, is going to enhance our student experience. You can't get an undergraduate degree now in most disciplines and not spend some time working in an entity, in an organization or a company. So we anticipate having 1,800 students that are coming to study there as a part of their off-campus experience. And the most important, equally important piece is that the corporate and other higher education partners that have decided to be part of this ecosystem to create an opportunity to drive economic vitality by educating more students here in the city of Chicago with the hope that they will stay in Chicago rather than going to Silicon Valley or to the East Coast and drive economic vitality. This is a fundamental statement that we believe that higher education and strategic partnership, public-private partnerships, or the key to the economic vitality of the state and to help move the city of Chicago to being a first-tier city in terms of research and innovation.
So this is companies working with the students in the city of Chicago?
Yes. We already know the model works because we have a research park down in Urbana-Champaign where 2,100 people come to work every day, including 800 of our undergraduate students. Hmm. Those 2,100 people are there because of their companies have decided to physically locate on our campus. And the major reason they're there is for access to our very bright students. Those students work during their academic programs, and then it's magical. Somehow or another, they end up being employed, at least first in line to be employed by these companies once they graduate.
To foot in, Illinois Chancellor Robert Jones is in our studio. We got to go, but Andrea reminded me, did you win a Grammy?
No, actually it was two, but who's counting?
For what?
Well, just for being the kind of guy I am.
All right, Andrea, darling, what did he win it for?
Just a little thing called singing.
I was just going to say, because he's got a voice to be a singer, but some of the spoken word Grammys, too, so yeah. I didn't know if he did something along those lines.
I had the great pleasure of being part of a choral ensemble called The Sounds of Blackness, and some of my best days were performing in this great city at different festivals,
wow.
The Gospel Festival, you name it, during the 90s and up to about 2010. I was with them for 30 years.
Are you called upon to sing now and again still?
Yes, but I say no. That was an important part of my life, and we were produced by Jim and Jam Harris and Terry Lewis.
Wow.
And got a recording contract because of Janet Jackson. The rest is history, as they say.
See, if that was me, that would be the first thing. Hi, I'm John, and did you know I have two Grammys? You buried the lead, sir.
Well, you have to remember, John, I'm from the Midwest, and I'm Midwest modern. Is still.
Yeah. Robert Jones. I don't know that I believe that entirely, but I like your style. University of Illinois Chancellor. Good luck. So one more time now, just so you know, Illini Fest in Chicago, July 18th. It's at Millennium Park from 3 to 6 in the Park Grill Plaza. Food, drinks, entertainment. Brought to you by the students, the staff, the faculty. Coach Lovie Smith will be there. Chancellor Jones will be there. Free Illinois flags for the first 1,000 to attend, and they're expecting a few thousand of you. They are doing Chicago Orange and Blue for the day. That's July 18th at Millennium Park. Thanks for coming into the studio.
My great honor. Thanks for having me.
153. This is WGN.
We've decided to make every day this week Friday. Fun, hilarity, music, food, talking about summer in Chicago, maybe even a Ann Arbor. In that vein, it's the 50th anniversary of Woodstock. Great Moments in Vinyl will be here to play some of the music, and we have a guy who was there for the whole thing and remembers it. Well, most of it.
Rock On with Anna DeVlantis. Chicago's conversation is on 720 WGN.
Individual rates, coverage offerings, and savings may vary, subject to terms and conditions, not available in all areas. If you're a small business owner, you know that getting workers' comp insurance can be a hassle and a costly investment. In fact, data suggests that up to 80% of small businesses overpay for workers' comp insurance by as much as 30%. At Pi Insurance, we've created a new way and a better way, built from the ground up for small business owners. With Pi, you can get a quote online in as little as 2 minutes from your computer or smartphone. Our workers' comp insurance is A-rated by AM Best and helps protect your business and your employees. Whether you're in retail, automotive, healthcare, construction, or another industry, we invite you to take a look at Pie Insurance. We're here to help you get the right coverage for your small business at the right price for your bottom line. Now, getting workers' comp insurance for your small business is as easy as pie. Get a quote online today at pieinsurance.com. That's pieinsurance.com.
By the way, we post a daily web question at WGNradio.com, and we'll post it on my Facebook page, too. Yesterday, we asked, should Netflix stop its characters from smoking on screen? There's pressure for them to do that. Steven Spielberg is remaking West Side Story for the studio that's now actually owned by Disney. And Disney said, we are not comfortable with smoking on this big screen. I don't know how you do West Side Story without the characters smoking, but the question was, should Netflix stop its characters from smoking on screen? 38% of you said yes, 62% of you said no. Those numbers surprised me a little bit. A conversation along those lines after two. Here today is Dr. Andre Popp. He's a MD, and our conversation is sponsored by Amida Healthcare Institute. Dr. Popp is a board-certified interventional cardiologist, and he's the co-medical director of the Heart Valve Program at Amida Heart and Vascular Institute. They specialize in that minimally invasive heart valve replacement. Dr. Popp, welcome to the show. You're on WGN Radio. How are you?
Wonderful. Thank you for having me, Gon.
I have to tell you, a minimally invasive heart valve replacement almost sounds like mutually exclusive terms. How can heart valve replacement be minimally invasive? You know what I mean?
Well, when we started with heart valve replacement, everything was done through open heart surgery. Basically, you would have to split the chest open and stop the heart. Since then, technology has advanced tremendously. And starting about 15 years ago, there's been development of valves that can be advanced through the vasculature, through the arteries to the heart to replace the valves on the inside without needing to open the chest.
It's amazing. So who are the candidates for this? How would I know if, in fact, I need to get this attended to?
Well, generally, patients have to be symptomatic, so they have to have shortness of breath, chest pain. It's generally a disease of older people. A lot of the patients that we're seeing are over the age of 70 or 75. And typically, they present with the symptoms that I described, as well as a heart murmur. And this is generally referred, recognized by their primary physician or by a cardiologist, after which they get referred to us for a multidisciplinary evaluation to decide the best way to replace their valve.
So it's not that I'm suffering a heart attack, I'm going into cardiac arrest, but maybe symptoms that are a little more benign?
Yeah, and the difficult part is that a lot of people who are older tend to slow down, and it's not easy to tease apart what's normal aging versus what can be a heart valve condition. And we spend a lot of time with our patients talking about this, talking to their families, and trying to figure out if it is the valve that's the problem or
right.
It's part of the normal aging process.
I guess since we might not be the best judges of that, all the more reason to schedule an appointment with a cardiologist at the Amida Health Heart and Vascular Institute. You can call 877-596-7403 or visit amidahealth.org/heartvalve for more information. Dr. Popp, thanks for coming on. We appreciate your expertise.
Thank you for having me.
Thinking big thoughts. So you don't have to.
It's what we do.
Here's John Williams.
Every day, all the way till 3. And then we do it when we're not on the air. We do it on Saturdays from 10 to noon. And we, on social media, are WGN King John. That's me. We're here all the way until 3 today. Thanks for tuning in. Griffin's in my ear. He said, remember, don't spoil the end of this show you're about to talk about. I would never do that.
Never, ever, ever.
I am accused often of doing that.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know, because I don't do it. And what I do is I'll tell people about the show, and I'll tell them interesting things about a movie or show, but I don't tell them how the show ends. And if I do, I've passed that invisible line that it's okay to now tell people how the movie ended.
When's for example?
That's a whole nother debate for a show I don't have time for.
Actually, earlier I said something about Sonny getting killed, and I was like, oh, spoiler.
Oh, come on.
That's
a 40-year spoiler, right?
It's a reflex in your brain.
Wait, Sonny as in...
The Godfather.
In The Godfather? We're not talking about Sonny and Cher or maybe some more recent Sonnies. Yeah, no, I think there's... And it's you know, where it's really a germane conversation these days. Mm-hmm. Brian Tallarico joins us now, the editor at RogerEbert.com. Okay, that's not why we called, but you're going to be part of this now. You ready, Brian?
Oh, I'm so ready.
Okay, but where I think the conversation is especially germane is when a whole series drops. I think that's what Griffin's concern was. So it's
right.
It's like, well, I could watch every episode of this season of Stranger Things and know about it, you know, within a day, how that series ends, and yet it might take people weeks to process the whole thing. So what are the rules of engagement there?
It's hard to say. I mean, I've written a couple pieces recently for the New York Times that go deep into the end of this season. And at the top, in all italics, we have, hey, people, spoilers, pay attention. And I still just had somebody yell at me on Twitter for spoiling things.
Okay, so what's a journalist to do? Maybe, I mean, I guess it's your responsibility to write about what you're writing about for the people that have watched it. And it's incumbent upon the reader to exit that conversation, huh?
I think so. And I think, especially something like this, like you said, Netflix just released numbers that 100 million people have already watched it. So for those 100 million people, there can be a conversation about what the team behind the show accomplished from first episode to last, that the other people can join in on later. For pre-air stuff, like I ran a review 3 days before it aired, and Netflix was very specific about what we could and could not say.
Oh, really?
We couldn't reveal nearly anything pre-air. They didn't. I mean, I'll drop things that are at the very beginning. We couldn't use the word Russian. We couldn't use, like, they didn't want, like, hardly anything mentioned pre-air. But once it's on, there is kind of like a, at a certain point, 100 million people want to discuss everything about it. You know what I mean? They don't want to discuss just the first episode or the fact that there are Russians under the mall.
If I've watched the series, what are we talking about here? Let's talk about the series, which includes the end. Don't worry, we're not about to in this conversation, but I appreciate how complicated that is. By the way, 100 million people, I don't know if I believe that. That would be 1 in 3 Americans.
I don't believe it either. Netflix's numbers have always come with a big grain of salt because there's no oversight to them. I mean, and no one's really quite sure what that means. Does that mean someone like autoplayed part of an episode and that counts as one of the people? You know what I mean? Where it like rolls into the next episode. So it's always been a little vague. And they said like something like more than that, watch the last Adam Sandler movie, to which we all went, no, that can't be true. So I don't know if I believe it either. Their numbers are a little inflated. But I'm sure a lot of people watched it based on responses I'm getting. And a lot of people, I think, watched all 8 hours in a row on the 4th of July. I know a ton of people who were ready to talk about the end before the day was over that it had first premiered. So
we watched at my house the first 2 seasons, and in season 3, everything but the last episode. We got last night, and we were kind of tired. It's pretty late now, and we really wanted to watch it, but we wanted to watch it, like, fresh. We didn't want to just plow through the damn thing, so we'll probably watch it, you know, fully engaged. You know, we'll get our blankie out. The dog will be in between us. We'll be zoned in on that last episode.
Okay.
Whatever. Why is it such a good series? Why all the buzz about this show?
Nostalgia is big right now. I mean, the 80s and a little bit of the 90s, but definitely the 80s. The generation that grew up with Steven Spielberg and John Carpenter and George Romero loves revisiting that era. And this show, created by the Duffer Brothers, knows how to mine that vein of nostalgia. The fact that we still watch Ghostbusters and Back to the Future, and they can weave it into a new plot line, make it feel fresh again. I think people love that kind of thing. It's wildly entertaining, especially this season. I'm very big on this season. I think it's their tightest season in terms of narrative. They waste almost no time. It's like 2 days of action, eight episodes.
This thing moves right along.
It flies, whereas in some past seasons, kind of had a little an episode here or there that where you felt like it sagged a little bit. There's zero sag this season, and the way it's structured in terms of getting all the characters around and back and focusing on different angles of the same mystery, I just think it's a really smart season of television. So I think it's good. I think that's attracting people.
Brian Tallarico is the editor at RogerEbert.com, who's been writing about Stranger Things. I've described it, I guess everybody has, right, as E.T. meets What does it meet in this case, Brian?
There's a lot of Stephen King in there. There was certainly it. The first
X-Files,
two,
maybe?
Yeah, a little. Yeah, well, the Stephen King books of the 80s are all over it. I mean, there's some Christine with the cars. There's it. So there's two Stevens is what I always say. It's King and Spielberg. Primarily, yeah. If you know your Stevens, you'll enjoy it.
You know,
this year there's some John Carpenter and George Romero too.
I tweeted last night that I'm making a list of ways I don't want to go based on television and movie viewing. And,
sure.
And the one that always reigned supreme for me was any of the aliens from the Alien series, right? Those little critters. I mean, that was just awful. Think about how creeped out you were by those things. You do not want to go that way. Number three on my list, but that's now number two. Number three on my list is the critters from The Mist, the whatever the hell was behind that foggy thing. That looked to me like a very unpleasant way to go. But I'll tell you what, that blob monster, the Flare from Stranger Things, the effects on that are, you do not want to die that way.
No. I mean, especially the way people are being impacted and possessed, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, right.
Again, no spoilers.
Right.
That's like episode one. No spoilers, people.
Oh, did I just
the way people
something?
Are being possessed. No. I'm just warning our listeners that we're not giving a lot away. But there's a really ugly way for townspeople who are, let's say, possessed by the Flare this season.
Yeah. Well, what's the worst way for you to go based on, and you can have the shark from Jaws, you can have whatever, you can go through the wood chipper if you want in Fargo. What's the worst way?
You brought it up, but it's not just getting attacked by them. It's John Hurt in Alien, where you're just having dinner, you feel like you're better, and then it comes right out of your chest.
That's tough.
Yeah, that's a bad one. And what's so great about that scene is the panic on his face and everyone else's. And that's probably one of the most famous film deaths of all time, and not a good way to go.
It's like, oh, this isn't just bad shrimp. I think an alien is going to come out of my stomach now.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. We don't need to dwell on that. But there's also some controversy of late that Netflix has been asked to dial back the smoking scenes in Stranger Things. Is that right?
Yeah.
I don't know how much
they were asked. I mean, they were pressured a little bit, but they kind of just came out and said, we're going to do this. What's going kind of underreported is that most of the studios have done this for years. Right around the turn of the decade, there was a big Surgeon General report that said that PG-13 and R movies were influencing smoking numbers among teenagers. And so all of the studios, Paramount, Sony, especially Disney, have internal memos and rules that you can't allow smoking in films aimed at teenagers or children, which is why we barely see it anymore. I mean, it's a shock to see a character smoke in a non-period film in a movie or TV show.
In a non-period film, but fair enough. And I'm comfortable with that. I also think it's relatively reflective. Fewer people smoke now than used to. It's seen as less glamorous, maybe even influential. But if you're going to remake West Side Story, don't they need to be smoking in that?
That's a good question, because, you know, they are remaking West Side Story. They probably should be, and they probably won't be, is what I'll say. Given today's climate, I don't think we'll see it.
Would they take the word cigarette out of that? So when you're a jet all the way from your first milkshake to your last time.
from your first
pirouette. The dancers, your first pirouette.
Your first jewel, your first jewel. Jewel pod.
That's a good question. I mean, Spielberg has the power to kind of do whatever he wants. But I think, wouldn't we all be a little surprised to see a cigarette even in a movie like that? I mean, I have to admit, when Hopper smoked in Stranger Things, I thought of it. I thought, you don't see that anymore.
Well, I think smoking in Stranger Things, it's a period piece. They were smoking in the middle 80s, but I think it's almost gratuitous. Like, okay, we know he's the no rules guy. He's the rough and tumble cop, and he smokes, damn it. But my God, he's smoking a lot.
Yeah, I think they're reflecting the pop culture, too, though. Believe it or not, I watched Ghostbusters with my boys for the first time the other day, and they all smoke. They smoke, like, in the Ghostbusters room. They smoke when they're talking.
Wait, the Ghostbusters smoke? I don't remember them smoking.
A couple
the characters
of them did.
Do? Really?
Bill Murray does, and Dan Aykroyd does, I think. Maybe Harold. Two of them did at one scene, and I was like, look at that. You don't see that much. I mean, we didn't notice it back then, and we don't care. But Bill is definitely smoking outside the library, and I think Dan is smoking later in the station.
And if they were going to remake that, nothing would be lost. If they were making that movie for the first time now, Ghostbusters, and they didn't smoke, nothing is lost there. But I think there's certainly context where smoking is relevant, or it's part of the character development.
Sure, and we'll still see it in period stuff. I just feel like, and but most of that period stuff, like a biopic or something like that, isn't aimed at teens. I think, like, Netflix is saying we're not going to do this at PG-13 or M-14 or whatever they call it on TV stuff, but if they do something like Triple Frontier, that Ben Affleck movie that's aimed at, that would be R-rated if it was in theaters, I think they'll still do it. And to be honest, as someone with three boys, I'm okay with that. Like, I'm okay with a shift away from things that my kids are going to see not having as much smoking, although, to be honest, it's raised... It allows me to talk to them about it, because otherwise they don't know it exists.
Well,
you know what I mean?
So. Okay, but I also think it's an interesting road you go down. Like, okay, I get it. That makes sense. But there's either a certain hypocrisy or you've set yourself up for something that maybe you don't want to do. Hollywood or Netflix. Let's pick it up here in just a minute. We're talking to Brian Tellerico. He's the editor at RogerEbert.com. This is WG. Brian Tellerico from RogerEbert.com is on a phone line with us. By the way, Brian is also a very good follow on Twitter. Brian_Tellerico, T-A-L-L, Tellerico. He writes about movies and TV and sports and his kids and how good it is to sometimes get away from them. Stuff like that. Am I right, Brian?
Yes, and how much I love them.
And how much you love them. I don't mean to say that you don't. By the way, John, Russians Under the Mall. Thanks, Brian. No, we didn't spoil anything.
Nothing.
Netflix international, hence 100 million people could have seen that show already?
Yes, yes.
I've seen Netflix, Spanish, Japanese. Yeah. It's funny, though, isn't it? I mean, I'm naive enough to think that major corporations do or do want to tell the truth. God, you should see Griffin's face right now. I don't think they will lie. But that's, it's hard to believe that this quickly 100 million people have seen Stranger Things. So there you are.
How honest do you think the movie studios would be if there was no oversight in them telling us how much a movie made every weekend? It's just that kind of thing that I'm like, okay,
yeah, right.
Maybe.
We were talking about the blobby monster called the Flayer in Stranger Things, and I said that's the worst way to go I can remember, but my listeners are saying this. Wood chipper in Fargo.
Yeah, sure.
Game of Thrones burning alive.
Yes.
The smoke monster from Lost was scary at first, but now it's kind of tame.
Right.
619 says Damien movies, attacked by Raven, eyes pecked out, then hit by a semi. Hello.
Yes.
Not a good way. And the list goes on, I guess. What a fun Facebook post. We're asking you what the most memorable way is that you don't want to go.
Yeah.
But by the way, so you were talking to us a little bit about how maybe you wouldn't mind it if studios and Netflix edited out or did not produce any more smoking scenes or characters that smoke so much, right?
Stuff that's aimed at young viewers, which Stranger Things undeniably is. Again, there was a report right around the turn of the decade where the Surgeon General came out and said, we have some pretty solid evidence that PG-13 smoking encourages smoking among teenagers. And if that's the, what's funny is I'm not one of those people who thinks like a lot of violence in movies contributes to violence in society, but I'm also one of those people who thinks extreme violence isn't always necessary to the story. So if smoking isn't necessary to the story, I mean, you and I grew up in a time when there was smoking in movies that didn't really need it. It was used to help make characters look cool. You know what I mean? Or it was used as a crutch, as an acting crutch. Tons of actors used it as an acting crutch for years. So if you can make a case that something needs it, like if we're going to make a movie about a World War II movie where soldiers smoked in the field, then that's fine. Or a war movie, I get it. But if you're going to make something with teenagers, I mean, wouldn't you be shocked to see a movie with teenagers smoking nowadays? You wouldn't see it. And I feel like that's okay. I feel like that's what Netflix is doing, and people are surprised, but I don't see that big a deal about it, to be honest.
Yeah, I think that's what makes West Side Story, the Steven Spielberg remake, such an interesting test case for this, because...
Right.
You could say it's not, you know, vital to the story, but it kind of is, too. I mean, it's a period
piece. I would argue it is.
I would argue it is because
of the period it's reflecting.
The period and the antisocial behavior that those guys engage in.
But if you were making West Side Story today, antisocial characters, gang members in the city or suburbs who are going to duel it out, and these aren't your honor students we're talking about here. So yeah, they would be smoking today too.
Again, but is that something aimed at a kid necessarily? Like, there will be tons of smoking in R-rated movies and R-rated shows on Netflix forever. In other words, it's the delineation between something that's aimed at 11-year-olds and something that's aimed at older. And I guess I would question why you would, like, you wouldn't need someone to smoke cigarettes in a show. I'm trying to think of a show that's definitely aimed at 11-year-olds other than Stranger Things, but you know what I'm getting at. Like, the shows that are targeting younger viewers, yeah, you wouldn't need that. They were certainly old enough by the end. It looked like they were old enough to smoke.
And there were some tough characters in Harry Potter, but they're not smoking cigarettes there behind the curtains, are they? Do we see that in any of the Harry Griffin's now looking to the sky trying to recollect any smoking scenes in the Harry Potter series?
No, I'm just coming up with Gandalf, but that's in Lord of the Rings. He does a lot of smoking.
All right, but here's we've got to go. But I mean, but are you guys both going down the slippery slope then? Then we shouldn't have alcohol depicted or premarital sex or hamburgers for that matter. It's sort of like when government
you very rarely have alcohol. I don't think there's much alcohol in the MCU unless it does a major character flaw, like Tony Stark. Like, you don't have these kind of vices in PG-13 films or TV shows in general. I think Netflix, I guess what I would conclude with is that Netflix came out and said we're going to do something, but almost everyone is already doing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, things aimed at PG-13 audiences don't include smoking and drinking. So, I mean, maybe they wanted to get credit for being ahead of the curve a little bit, but I feel like almost all the studios and TV networks do this anyway.
That's an interesting point. Brian Tallarico is the editor at RogerEbert.com. Do you check out that site? Very user-friendly, very easy to sort of catch views and reviews. And he's a good follow on Twitter as well. That's Brian_Tallarico. Follow him on Twitter. Okay, Brian.
Thank you, John.
As always, thanks for your time today.
Yeah, take care.
Anymore. 720 WGN. Producer Griff, what are we listening to here?
That's Carly Rae Jepsen.
Of course it is. Why are we playing Carly Rae Jepsen?
Well, why for the third time in 2 months? I don't know.
Always on Saturdays feature a little musical interlude for us, and then you explain to us why. Why is she on your mind today?
She's playing at the Chicago Theater tonight.
You going to go?
No.
You're a Carly Rae Jepsen fan?
I have several friends that are going. I'm very jealous.
And it's cool to like Carly Rae?
I hate to say it, but yes, yeah. And I feel bad jumping on the bandwagon when it got cool, but what are you going to do? It's good. I really like it.
Yeah, no kidding.
Maybe not everyone agrees with me, by the way, that it's cool. But
She's at the Chicago Theater?
Yes.
About 2,000, is that about capacity there? 2,500, something like that?
Something.
She's a 2,500, she's not the United Center type artist.
No,
right?
Yeah, no.
In our studio is Andrew Schaefer. He is the author of the book Hope Never Dies and Now Hope Rides Again. It's about the dynamic crime-fighting duo of Barack Obama and Joe Biden. Am I right about that?
Oh, you're absolutely correct.
Welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm not the United Center type either, though. I should add.
Yeah, right. Although you are doing a signing this evening.
I am. Not at the United Center or the Chicago.
At the 57th Street, 57th Street Books. It's 6 o'clock tonight. It's free and open to the public. So if you want to kind of catch this guy's act, Andrew Schaefer. So tell me about the first book and what the impetus for that was.
Yeah, the first book sort of came together a couple months after Barack Obama and Joe Biden had left office. I'd been thinking about it. There were a lot of memes going around, which are the pictures of them having their bromance, which was they're hanging out at a basketball game or, you know, having fun.
But the vibe is always in those memes. It was always Joe saying something that would cause Barack to blanch and then say, now, Joe, it's not that way.
Right. He would always say something. He'd be like, so you're going to adopt me now, right? And then Barack Obama would go, Joe, listen up, Joe. It's not going to happen. He goes, it's been 8 years. You're out on your own now. So
I'm familiar with that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I said, you know, in my mind, I'm like, this should be real. this should be out there. You know, neither one of them are going to talk about it, though, that private conversations they have. But it just looked like they were having a lot of fun together, no matter what words you put in their mouths. And I was like, I want to get them together. I want to do a book about this. And the best way to do that, I mean, was you can't just have them holding hands for 300 pages. I said, let's give them a murder mystery to solve, because that harkens back to the first bromance, you know, in literature, I think, which was Sherlock and Watson. So there's sort of a direct line there between that and the Obama-Biden mysteries.
Or more recently, you've got the black-white buddy cops, one
yes.
old, one young, one rascally, one not, you know, just you know, and then they play off of each other.
Yeah.
So that was kind of turnkey for you if you wanted to just does it play like that when you write about them?
Yeah, it's very much a Lethal Weapon type 48 hours. I'm trying to think of something more recent than that, which was the new Lethal Weapon. Sorry.
Yeah. But what's so in the first book, what's the crime that they're solving?
Yeah. In the first book, there is an Amtrak conductor dies under mysterious circumstances. Barack Obama has some information that he may have been murdered. And so together they have to solve that crime. Now it starts off like all buddy cop dramas and, you know, comedies. It starts off with them kind of not on the same team, because Barack has been off hang gliding and jet skiing with Richard Branson, sort of auditioning for a new best friend.
And he really is Barack Obama, the former president, right?
Yeah. So in this book, it's a fictional world. I should add that up front, because I have had a few folks that have been confused about that, a few and far between. Someone said they need to stay out of, leave this up to real detectives. We don't need amateur sleuths. Well, yeah, I agree. We don't. They should stick to politics. Although, you know, I don't know if anyone's seen the debates recently.
So Brock's off jet skiing with his new rich buddies, auditioning, if you will, for his new number two.
Mm-hmm.
And then where does Joe Biden come in?
Oh, Joe Biden's sitting at home watching YouTube videos of this, watching TMZ, saying, what's going on? He forgot about me. Not even a gosh darn, you know, Facebook poke or anything. This is because he's probably the only one that still uses Facebook poke. I don't know if some of the kids out there probably don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, right, exactly. So Joe eventually teams up with Barack,
yeah, they
and now they're trying to solve the crime.
They team up and try to solve the crime together, and through solving that crime, they become best buds again. I mean, sorry, it's kind of a spoiler there, but you do know we have the sequel, Hope Rides Again, which the first book was set in Wilmington, Delaware. The second book is set right here in Chicago. So it was a really fun book for me to write.
Hope Never Dies. So what's the crime now?
In Hope Rides Again, Obama's BlackBerry goes missing. So we have a few callbacks to the Obama administration. We have his BlackBerry. If you could see the cover right now, Obama is in his scandalous tan suit. Oh, I mean, what a national security crisis that was.
It was a controversy.
It
wasn't becoming a president, a tan suit. Imagine that.
Hashtag yes, we tan. It was unbelievable at the time, and now it just seems like, oh, those good old days. And that's set right here in Chicago. And so they go all over Chicago. It starts off at the Tribune Tower. They head down to Hyde Park, Inglewood, Navy Pier, Lake Michigan. It really has.
Are they doing the usual? So to be clear, last year it was Hope Never Dies,
mm-hmm.
and now the new book is Hope Rides Again, and now they're in Chicago solving a crime. And are they doing the sort of gumshoe work that private eyes do? You know, are they finding mysterious clues? And Brock says, Joe, look at this. What do you think that could mean?
Yeah. It's all about, you know, I watch the Sherlock television show, and you just get so frustrated. You're like, those guys are so smart on there. And look, he's like, this particular dirt comes from this alley in this area of London. And I'm like, who knows that? No, this is, they're very good politicians. They're kind of just average sleuths, though. So the crimes that they solve are serious, but it's really fun when you see someone who's not good at something, you know, or who's really good at one thing, try to do something else. You go, oh, they're human.
Yeah,
it's kind of humanizing to see them out of their element. It's like Michael Jordan trying to play baseball.
So, good point. Nice. Nice image. So give me a scene where they are the characters we know, but in this environment that we're not familiar with. Take me to a point in the story.
One of the the funnest points here is when it starts off the story. Joe Biden, like I said, he's sitting at home playing on his computer here in Hope Never Dies, watching Obama, and then he sees out in the yard there's like a flicker of light, and he thinks that could be a firefly, or is there a prowler in my backyard? Who's back there? And so it's a very noir sort of open, and he goes outside and to the edge of the woods. His dog Champ runs out and greets this person who he realizes in the shadows is not a stranger. And he gets up close, and there it's a cigarette. He smells the brand, Obama's brand. He's got it between his fingers, like, and Obama says, "Hey, long time no see," you know. And that's really what starts off the book, is you go, oh my gosh, what happened between these two? I thought they were best friends in office. It's been 6 months and all of a sudden they're split up. Well, you know, It's the books are also about like male friendships, which you don't really see analyzed, I think, like this in books a lot. And if you do in movies, it's a little bit more on the macho side.
Might help your franchise, since Joe Biden, lo and behold, as a courtesy to you, has decided to run for president again. Oh,
Dios mío. That was the debates were. You know,
is the Joe Biden that we're seeing on TV today, and some of the sort of, you know, looking back at his career or his behavior, his awkward caressing of people, did you see that coming in your books?
Did you have him
blowing in anybody's ear or giving them inappropriate shoulder massages?
I will say there's a whole chapter in the new book, Hope Rides Again. I wrote this before he started to run here. And it actually has to do with Joe Biden's high school nickname, which was, and I don't know why this isn't all over the news, but his nickname in high school was Hands.
Is that true, or that's you?
No, that is true. Hands. Like the things that are at the end of your arms,
Griffin, look
your
that
hands.
Up. I don't know that I believe that.
It's entirely true. It was because he was the best wide receiver on the football
well,
team.
Of course he would be.
And he gave great massages after games. But, you know, no, the second part's not true. The first part is true.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So do you have any – you've thought more about Joe Biden than we have. What do you think about his viability or his ability right now?
I don't see Joe changing who he is. He hasn't changed in – you know, he's worn the same suits, the same outfits for 50 years. He picked what he liked, and he stuck with it. You know, he's that kind of guy. He's not going to change overnight or over the course of a campaign. You know, there's not going to be a pivot here. He is who he is, and – nothing that he's said or done has really surprised me. So I think it's just people haven't really looked that closely at him before. But I would say that, you know, during the 2008, you know, run, President Obama and his advisors had looked very closely at Joe and looked at all this stuff and said, hey, you know, it's Joe. You know what you're getting, at least. And so that's the only thing I would say, is I don't think any of this stuff is really that surprising to me.
Hope Never Dies, the first book. Hope Rides Again. Andrew Schaefer's in our studio. This, to me, looks like a funny movie. Have you sold the rights to this?
Yeah. I did sell the rights. You know, you don't have anything that's come out of that just yet. But, you know,
Would this be six episodes on Netflix, or would it be a major motion picture starring somebody as them?
I'm cautiously optimistic. It would be a TV series. It would probably be a cartoon, I'm thinking.
Like TV Funhouse on Saturday Night Live?
Yeah, because when you cast someone else to play someone, it turns into a caricature. And I'm like, no, I want this to be like a real sort of a noir tone, you know, to it. It has a serious tone. And I think that's the reason that this book... the books really work. You know, don't listen to me, listen to the people that have bought the book. but I think what works is that it's a silly concept, Barack Obama and Joe Biden as crime fighters. But if I take it seriously, people will buy into it. And so it really, the mystery is serious. And I think
so. You're not writing this for laughs. You're actually telling the story of them seriously, what it would be like if they became crime fighters.
Right. It's a completely dry, deadpan tone.
Would you do a George Bush, Dick Cheney
I thought about doing a George W. Bush, Michelle Obama type book because they've had this sort of nice little friendship. But then I said, you know, I think that some people see that, and I don't know if they're really that ready to invest 300 pages in that relationship.
And is Brock the brains of the outfit, and Joe uses maybe his charm and personality to tweeze clues out of suspects? Is that how it goes?
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. Barack Obama is definitely the Sherlock here, and I tried to write from his perspective a little bit, and you just can't. You don't want to know what's going on in the genius's head. It's so smart, you know? So that's why it's narrated by Joe Biden. It's kind of down to earth.
The books are good for the covers alone. Just the swashbuckling action-adventure imagery on the front of them is funny. And the books are called Hope Never Dies and Hope Rides Again. They're out in paperback.
They are indeed. Paperback, ebook, audiobook.
And Andrew Schaefer is going to be appearing at 57th Street Books tonight at 6 o'clock. It's free and open to the public. You'll read from it, I guess, a favorite passage.
Oh, not only will I read from it, but we have some giveaways. We have a Joe Biden scented candle, Barack Obama scented candle, and, you know, I might have a few other little surprises in store for people, but I always try to make it fun. People say, what have I got to do at a reading? Do I got to listen to you? And I'm like, that's part of it.
Yeah, it'll be a little bit of that.
Yeah.
Andrew, good luck to you. Thanks for coming into the studio.
Oh, thanks so much, John.
It's Hope Never Dies and Hope Rides Again. You're a crime-fighting duo of Barack Obama and Joe Biden.
The best Chicago sports conversations start here every weekday morning. The Steve Cochran Show on 720 WGN.
Individual rates, coverage offerings, and savings may vary, subject to terms and conditions, not available in all areas. If you're a small business owner, you know that getting workers' comp insurance can be a hassle and a costly investment. In fact, data suggests that up to 80% of small businesses overpay for workers' comp insurance by as much as 30%. At Pi Insurance, we've created a new way and a better way, built from the ground up for small business owners. With Pi, you can get a quote online in as little as 2 minutes from your computer or smartphone. Our workers' comp insurance is A-rated by AM Best and helps protect your business and your employees. Whether you're in retail, automotive, healthcare, construction, or another industry, we invite you to take a look at Pi Insurance. We're here to help you get the right coverage for your small business at the right price for your bottom line. Now getting workers' comp insurance for your small business is as easy as Pi. Get a quote online today at PieInsurance.com. That's P-I-E insurance.com.
Home prices have gone up by 50% in the last 6 years. However, it seems values are peaking. You've probably also heard the Federal Reserve has raised the Fed funds rate 4 times in 2018 alone. But mortgage rates have actually dropped by 0.5 point since late last fall. Maybe it's time to put that equity to work, like paying off very high credit cards, student loans, or remodel your house. Hi, I'm Wesley Hoagland with Westland Financial. Let us put you in a position to do any of these things with no closing costs. That's right. Nothing's rolled into your loan, whether it's conventional, FHA, or VA will pay your title, settlement, lender, and recording fees. Or maybe you just want to refinance out of your mortgage insurance. All it takes is a 5-minute phone call to see how we can save you thousands of dollars a year. So call Westland at 888-455-3669. It's the biggest no-brainer in the history of mankind. Call us at 888-455-3669. That's 888-455-3669.
Westland Financial Corp., an Illinois residential mortgage licensee located at 200 East Sandpoint Avenue, Suite 800, Santa Ana, California, 92707. NMLS number 3304. Not all loans apply. Equal housing lender.
Joint pain and injuries can occur anytime. Illinois Bone and Joint Institute makes accessing orthopedic care and treatment simple. 7 walk-in ortho access clinics provide immediate care from bone and joint specialists without a visit to the ER. Their clinics have in-office x-ray and MRI to deliver test results to your doctor faster than other providers. And their on-site physical and occupational therapy gives you stress-free treatment all at one location. Open evenings and weekends. Visit Illinois Bone and Joint Institute at IBJI.com to find the facility or specialist near you.
Thank you, Andrew Schaefer, for coming in. By the way, he has written about other politicians fictionally before Donald Trump became president. He wrote Day of the Donald, and it was about Donald Trump becoming president. And he said, don't worry, it's just fiction. It'll never happen. And he said his friends blame him for what happened as a result. Or maybe slap him on the back and say thank you very much. If you need new windows or doors for your home, call the company recommended by Lou Manfredini of House Smarts Radio called Gilkey Windows. Gilkey manufactures the highest quality vinyl and fiberglass windows in an endless variety of styles and colors. Call Gilkey now. And for a limited time, you can get up to 35% off on fiberglass or vinyl windows and doors. No interest financing for up to 12 months. Call Gilkey, 888-3-GILKEY, 888-3-GILKEY. Our news click at WGNRadio.com yesterday was, should Netflix stop its characters from smoking? And 62% of you said no. 38% of you said yes. I thought the 38% number was kind of high. 62% of you said no, but over a third of you are like, yeah, let's dial that back. I don't want anybody to decide how those things are done. I don't want the corporate overlords or the PC police to decide what art is like. And at the end of the day, that's what it's supposed to be.
I feel the same, but I will say you watch old movies and they're all smoking and they... I don't endorse what I'm about to say, but the truth is, like, they look cool. They do look pretty cool, and so, and that's powerful. So I start to rethink, like, it's probably better that we don't have people. It's,
well, there you
I kind of I bounce back and forth.
Why we have a generation of people that smoked for a variety of reasons, but one of them was probably that, right? That
it helped, probably, and that's not good. So
remember how everybody just lost their mind when Mad Men came out? And we were...
They do a lot of smoking on that show, and they look very cool on that show.
But that was also reflective of the era, too, right? So when you went into the doctor's office, he would be smoking. If you watch Johnny Carson, he's smoking there. Imagine, you know, any of your nighttime TV hosts sitting there with a cigarette.
We had a call from Dave talking about the movie A League of Their Own, where Madonna's trying out for the baseball team at Wrigley Field, or whatever the field is, and smoking a cigarette during her tryout.
Well, you look at old snapshots of players in the Cubs dugout. I don't remember how far back this was, but it wasn't that far back. And there's one of the players sitting there in the dugout, one of the players smoking.